I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 16th, 2024. The time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. I wonder what happened to mine. There it is, and it's turned off. Okay. Members present today, Senator Klayman, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman. Senator Wilkowski is online. Co-Chair Bishop is here, and I'm Senator Giesel. Excused absence today, Senator Kawasaki. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Sav and to Dylan for helping us out recording the minutes and helping us with the audio. Two items on the agenda today. Number one, overview of the Agricultural Division of the Department of Natural Resources, and the first hearing of Senate Bill 171, Residency Requirement, Hunting, Trapping, Fishing, by Senator Bjorkman. So we'll start out with the Agriculture Review, and I welcome to the table Commissioner John Boyle from the Department of Natural Resources. Online, I see Deputy Commissioner Brent Goodrum from Natural Resources as your lifeline. I see also here Director Brian Scoresby, Division Director, might be online, but he's not there at the moment, Commissioner. So welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Giesel, Co-Chair Bishops, and honorable members of the Resources Committee. For the record, this is John Boyle, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. And yes, I hope Director Scoresby will be on in short order, as he is the consummate subject matter expert and my eyes and ears in the world of agriculture. But, you know, we're really excited to talk to you today about agricultural opportunities here in the state. Hopefully this week, you guys had the opportunity to visit with the Food and Farm Caucus and associated stakeholders like the Farm Bureau and others that were down here talking about Alaska agriculture. We, you know, it is a small sector of our state economy, but it's an important and a vital sector of our state economy. And it's really an important function within DNR that sometimes gets overlooked in the context of all the other divisions that we oversee, but certainly we're very much focused on agriculture within DNR and the opportunities that exist for us to grow the state's opportunities there. So you'll see a number of bucolic pictures there that highlight the beauty of our state. And I would say, you know, you're hard pressed to find another state that has can pull out farm photos that are as lovely as ours. So with that, I'll jump into it. You know, agriculture and food security are of great importance to many Alaskans. So I took the liberty as a backyard agriculturalist. That's my son tending to one of the crops of young chicks that we've raised up and currently provide eggs for my family. And then my daughter and I standing in front of our small apiary in the backyard, kind of trying to impute the values of beekeeping to the next generation of Alaskans. But, you know, that's, in a way, this is really reflective of who Alaskans were as a state. In the early days of territoryhood, Alaska actually produced more than 50% or more of the food that they consumed. And of course, you know, today that has dropped down to now in the single digits. And there's myriad reasons that have led to that distribution, but certainly I think when we talk about agriculture in Alaska, we are talking about a wide spectrum of agricultural practices, from folks like me that utilize their backyard spaces for growing homegrown food to our larger commercial farmers that also play a vital role in Alaskan food security. But the state has enormous potential, and I think that's the one thing that we often overlook. You know, as I've gone out and visited with and talked to agricultural secretaries and commissioners and ministers in various places, everywhere around the country, the main concern is losing agricultural land to development. There's every year that goes by, there's fewer and fewer acres actually in agricultural use. It's the pressures of growing cities, expanding industries and just rising land values create issues for agriculture. But here in Alaska, the one great resource that we have is land and land availability and the availability of land for agricultural purposes. So amongst all most of the jurisdictions in the world, we really stand in a great place to offer more opportunities when it comes to Alaska. And I've spent a lot of my time as commissioner really thinking about how do we marshal the resources of the state and how do we lay out a strategic framework for how we can build and grow agricultural opportunities overall. So there's two, you know, main goals that we look at when it comes to agriculture in the state. And one, of course, is greater food security and independence for Alaskans. And of course, the jobs and value chain benefits of the well-developed economic sector. We learned a lot of lessons through COVID, and that is the tenuousness of supply chains and just-in-time processes and things of that nature. The governor, you know, for him, it was a major wake-up call when he got a call from the Port of Seattle-Tacoma saying that they may have to shut down operations for a period of time. With the Canadian border, we received that call that, you know, access to Canada was going to be restricted for a period of time. And so as we think about our reliance on ports, on roads, and in a relatively constrained supply chain to actually bring the food that we need to the state, I think it should give all of us pause to think how reliant we are on those systems and the vulnerability that we have in case of pandemic, natural disaster, civil unrest or war, any other kind of event that might present an impediment to those supply chains being able to deliver food reliably to the state. And so one of our main focuses, of course, is how can we build that resilience within the state? How can we produce more of the food that we all rely on? And so, you know, part of that methodology that we're looking at, of course, is putting more land into the hands of would-be farmers or existing farmers through projects like the Nanatichaket agricultural project, which we'll talk about in a little more detail here in some upcoming slides, but also creating environments where we can lower costs, right? How can we make it cheaper for seeds and implements and tractors and how can we improve on the services that farmers need, like mechanics and other things that are important to servicing the equipment that they utilize. Thinking about value-added manufacturing, the types of infrastructure that we need for things like seed cleaning and otherwise, these are all the types of factors that we look into in terms of building out that economic sector and value chain for agriculture. So just, you know, recently when it comes to the data that we have on agriculture in the state, we find ourselves a little challenged because there's not necessarily a methodology or a particular study that encapsulates really all that's going on in the world of agriculture here in the state, but we do have the Census of Agriculture, which the Department, U.S. Department of Agriculture puts out every 7 years or so. And so we actually just got this week the data from 2022 this week. That includes a voluntary survey from farmers in Alaska to share with the USDA what they're doing, what kind of crops are growing, what kind of economic activity ensues. And so this helps shape some of our worldview in terms of what we know that we've got going on. What we are seeing, though, is that at least response rates have been declining nationally with this survey. We had 72% roughly responding rate back in 2017. That's now dropped to 61%. So, you know, what are the factors that are leading to that? I don't know. You know, farmers might want to keep things closer to the vest. But at least this does provide some window, some insight into kind of what we've got going on. And so part of what we would like to do within the Department of Natural Resources is to try to build out our data sets, understand better the landscape that we have in Alaska agriculture. So, again, it helps frame up for us what factors we need to have in place when we think of a strategic roadmap for agriculture. So some of the highlights that I'm happy to share with the committee is that we have seen a marked increase in the amount of farms here in the state. So as you can see, we've increased from about 990 farms in 2017 to just under 1,200 farms here in 2022. Land that farms are currently utilized or at least designated for agricultural purposes have increased from just under 850,000 acres in 2017 to now just under 870,000 acres in 2022. We've seen the value of our agricultural products sold increased from $70.5 million in 2017 now to just under $91 million in 2022. And you can see from the kind of breakdown of those products, so for crops, things like barley, wheat, hay, oats, et cetera, that's increased from $29.6 million to just under $40 million. And then in animal products, that's our cows, our sheep, our goats, things of that nature, dairy, we've seen that increase from just under $41 million to just over $51 million here in 2022. So I think the good news is that we see that economic activity, demand for agricultural products, opportunities for farmers in Alaska are generally increasing. And so again, I think a key focus for the department and a key consideration, I would say, for the legislature is how can we continue to provide that environment that fosters and encourages continued growth in the sector.
Senator Klayman, question?
Yes, specific to the $90.9 million in 2022, and not in any way to have any impact on the importance of growing the agricultural industry in Alaska, but in terms of the total volume of essentially food that's sold in the market, how does that 91 million compare to the total quantity of these products sold statewide, which are obviously coming from outside Alaska, or the majority coming from outside Alaska?
Yeah, Senator Klayman, through the chair, that's an excellent question. I'm going to see if either Deputy Commissioner Goodrum or Director Scoresby, if he's online, if they readily have that information on hand. If not, we'll happily get back to the committee with that.
And Mr. Scoresby has signed on. He's the director of the Division of Agriculture for DNR. I also want to point out that Mia Kirk is online. She's a manager, Agriculture, Market, and Inspection Services, Division of Agriculture, DNR. So we'll start with Director Scoresby, see if he can answer your question. Mr. Scoresby, can you hear us? And did you hear Senator Klayman's question?
Yes. My name is Brian Scoresby, director of the Division of Agriculture, Department of Natural Resources. Through the chair, Senator Klayman, if you would please repeat your question so that we have clarity on our end for an answer.
Sure. The question is, how does that 90.9 million or roughly 91 million in 22, how does that compare, or what percentage of that is that to the total amount of agricultural products that are sold statewide?
If I'm thinking correctly, that 90.9 million is the gross domestic ag product in the state.
So, correct. Yes.
Okay. Follow up.
If
I go to the grocery store, sadly, the majority of what I see in the grocery store isn't grown in Alaska, and I'm trying to get an understanding of how does that 90.9 million, the gross state product, compare to the total products sold in the state in that same year?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, that 90.9 million is all product that is sold. How much of it goes into the grocery line for edible food is closer to about 40 million. But to get you an exact answer, we would have to consult the NAS report and give you a follow-up answer in writing in a couple of days.
Thank you, Director Scoresby. And I think what Senator Klayman was asking is this number, 91 million, compared to the amount of lower 48 foods, the value of lower 48 foods sold here.
Right.
Is this 91 million a tenth when you compare it to how much is sold in food product from the lower 48, or what percent?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And I think it's not just exactly, probably not just food in the grocery store. If we're actually having to ship up boatloads of hay to feed agricultural to agricultural stuff, I don't think there is. But I'm interested in finding how does our state production, which I think is essential, and I'm very supportive of growing that production. But I think to really understand the picture, it's good to know what are we buying if we've got 40.8 million of animal products or 51.2 million of animal products sold in the state, how many million of animal products are sold from outside the state? Because I think that's a pretty valuable thing to bear in mind in terms of food security.
Yes, Senator Klayman, through the chair, this is John Boyle again, commissioner for the record. We'll be happy to provide that data. It's a relevant question. I think kind of going back to one of my opening statements, we know that we're only producing less than 10% of the amount of food that we're consuming in the state. So you could, in a rough sense, back of the envelope, extrapolate that out to get an estimate for actually how much value of agricultural products that we're importing that are being produced in other parts of the country. But we'll work on getting you that exact figure so you have it on hand.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman?
Several years ago, I remember talking to a restaurant owner in Alaska, and I said, so are you able to get all your pork from in Alaska? And their answer was, I'd love to get all the pork from in Alaska, but my restaurant would consume more pork than is even produced in Alaska, so I have to go outside to get the pork. And that always has resonated with me, that our local producers are so essential, but it still is sadly a small percentage of the total consumption. Thank you.
All right. I see no further questions.
All right. Very good. Well, moving on. So this slide also uses primarily this National Agriculture Statistics Service, which the director mentioned under the acronym NAS. Gives us a little more insight into what agriculture in Alaska looks like. So on the left, we see the major crops that are grown in the state. So that's grass hay, barley, oats, wheat, potatoes, and seed potatoes. And then on the right, we see the estimated amount of acres in Alaska for these crops. So you'll note that vegetables crop data really isn't reported. I don't know how many of you have had the pleasure of eating a Palmer carrot, but Palmer carrots are far superior to any of the orange substitutes that they import from other states. There's something about the amount of sunlight that our crops receive in the summer that enables them to produce more sugars than their counterparts grown in lower latitudes. And the result is we get delectable sweet carrots and delicious potatoes, which I think really help differentiate and set the standard for what carrots ought to taste like. Those particular data points aren't incorporated in this report, which is why we could come up with some rough estimations for what's currently being produced, but we don't have a firm handle on that. And our estimates for oats and wheats are what the Division of Agriculture averages over 11 years using Farm Service Agency data. And our potato acreages are also kind of division estimates. We know that there's additional non-hay acres grown here in the state that's not reflected in this chart. There's a number of folks all over the place that grow their own timothy or brome or other things that aren't encapsulated within this. So our best estimates is that there's probably at least an additional 8,000 acres of both barley, oats, alfalfa that are being harvested for forage and being used to help supply feedstocks for horses and cattle and other animals that are being raised here in the state. So, I mean, these estimates really here are just to help give us some perspective in that. And of course, these are key crops, but you know, keep in mind that their position in the value chain, they can touch multiple layers. So of course, as we look at the 6,000 acres of barley, if you go to the supermarket, you may see a brand called Black Gold, which is a barley brand, and it's produced up at the Wrigley Farm in Delta, and they make a whole host of barley-related products, phenomenal products. I've personally sampled them myself, and as you know, my rotundity would attest, I'm a very, you know, I'm an expert on sweets and breads and carbs and of the like, and these are great products. And so this is one of the thing. Barley is one of those crops that grows exceptionally well here in the state. The variety of barley that we grow, Sunshine Barley, was a variety that the University of Alaska Fairbanks helped develop. And it's the variety that we continue to grow that does well up here. But in addition to making delicious baked goods, the husks of that barley are then used for animal feed. So you have, I mean, really the key for agriculture is ensuring that every output from that sector is being put into some sort of productive use. And so, you know, with barley, we can get food products, we can get animal feed. The same can be true for potential future products like camelina, which is a very exciting crop that the University of Alaska Fairbanks is currently working, developing in trials. But if we look for the opportunities where you could create potential biofuels, create oils, and then use the remainder for a high-protein animal feed input, again, you can build value in a lot of different areas of the supply chain. So that's why all agriculture is important, because there's just so much that we can put to use in so many different contexts.
Senator Bishop, you had a question.
I have a comment and a question. Thank you. I'm sure, Commissioner, it's good to see you. It's just an observation. On this page, there's about 28,000 acres in production. And yet the previous page before, there's 850,000 acres of farmland. And so, do you know of that 850,000 acres, do you have a good feel for why it's not into production, et cetera, et cetera? Because I want to come back to the barley from Delta. So I'm glad you touched on the biofuels. My daughter burns barley from Delta in her pellet stove in Fairbanks, and it burns hotter than the wooden, and it smells like cinnamon. A cinnamon toast coming out the exhaust. So.
Senator Bishop, through the chair. Well, thank you for yet another marketing slogan that we can look at when marketing Alaska-grown produce. I think we all enjoy the smell of cinnamon toast. So, yeah, I think that's a great observation. I'll just offer some preliminary comments, and then I'll see if my either Director Scoresby or Deputy Commissioner Goodrum want to supplement. It's one of the key questions that I've asked. Clearly, the state has developed a number of agricultural projects over the years. We can think of Point McKenzie, we can think of Delta, we can think of the project there near Anderson and Clear that I'm blanking out on the moment. Obviously, farmland out in the Matanuska and Susitna valleys, and now the Nenana-Chechaket project. And so, I mean, one of the questions was my first question, which is, if we already have a lot of agricultural land that's being underutilized or unutilized, then really what are the key factors that are driving that? And a lot of it is just economics. We have farmers that are utilizing a certain portion of agricultural lands for current agricultural production. But there's a number of what I would describe as chicken and egg problems. That is, if there's not a ready market, if there's not an assurity that if they produce more that they can sell it, farmers, of course, tend to be conservative, and they want to only grow that which they feel confident can be sold. And so, to me, a lot of what our focus should revolve around in the department is how can we help provide opportunities for these farmers to have increased access to markets, and whether that's shelf in a store, whether that's international markets, whether that's programs like that we've just implemented with the barley grain reserve, that is having a co-op that will guarantee that that if a certain amount of barley is grown every year or whatever, that crop will be purchased and stored and utilized. Farmers will will increase to meet that demand. And so that is one of the things that we're working on, but I'll just open it up maybe to Director Scoresby if he wants to add any more detail to that.
Director Scoresby?
Okay. Through the chair, Brian Scoresby, Director of Division of Ag. If you would repeat the question to me so I can give you an accurate answer, please.
Sure. I was just making the comparison between slide 6, which we're on now, and there's about 28,000 acres in production. Okay. The previous slide 5, we have 850, I'm just going off of memory, 850,000 acres on that slide that are, I believe it says, let me flip back. It says 850,000 acres. Farms increased from 850,000 acres in 2017 to 869,000 acres in 2022. And I was just wondering, what are the barriers to increasing I know, but I just want to hear from you guys why we don't have more crop production. Because to the commissioner's point, he asked a question. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, Brian Scoresby, Director of the Division of Ag. To answer your question, there is a lot of numbers or acreage in between that are not currently in production. They're agriculture acres, but they're not currently being farmed. Speculation would tell us why. We could make those answers, but truly the landowner, and we'd have to poll each landowner to know why they're not actively farming those acres.
Thank you.
So moving on, we were also asked to, this is John Boyle, Commissioner for the Record. We were asked to include an update on the Nanana-T'Chaket Agricultural Project. So that project incorporates 140,000 acres of state land that we have designated as being suitable for agriculture that we plan on disposing in the coming decades. And we really appreciate the legislature's support for this exciting endeavor and the funding that we've received thus far to build out the infrastructure to enable this area to be developed. This area was actually identified in the late 70s for agricultural developments, and of course it enjoys really favorable access to some key transportation routes. So we have the river system in the area, we have the Parks Highway, and we have the railroad, all of which can play a key role in helping move products produced in that area to market. So critically, a bridge was built over the Nenana River, and that bridge was completed in 2020, and now there's a great bridge and a road that extends far out into the agricultural project. And we offered, I think, the first phase for sale the year before last, and we saw a lot of success in that. So we had 2,000 acres that we offered in a sealed bid, offered either at sealed bid auction or over-the-counter sales, and we saw strong local and national interest in that land offering in the 27 parcels that were offered, 24 of which were ultimately sold, and the vast majority of those were to Alaskans. And we've already started to see the successful bidders and purchasers of some of those parcels start clearing the land and planning their lots. So some of you may remember at the governor's State of the State address, he invited a family called the Coffees, who are one of the successful bidders in that land sale. And they have been actively clearing now over 100 acres of land that they've acquired. And this year was actually able to grow a crop of sweet corn in the state, which is one of the first broader, I guess, crops of sweet corn that we've seen grown in the field. Certainly anecdotally, I know people in the valley that have been growing sweet corn either through hoop houses or just kind of in favorable microclimates, you know, alongside their homes where they get enough heat, and they've started those corn seedlings out early in a greenhouse or what have you. But to actually see corn being able to be sown and harvested out in the field, in the open, without other sorts of inputs to raise, to see that corn come into fruition is exciting. Because if we can grow sweet corn in the field like that, that is a very important input that we can be utilizing for animal feed and the like. And one of the things that we're seeing with climate change is that our seasons are lengthening. And just even having a few extra days of non-frost days can make the difference between whether a certain type of crop can grow here or not. And so for all intents and purposes, as Alaska warms and as our growing season lengthens, the amount of crops and the types of crops that we're going to be able to grow here are going to increase. So this is just another, climate change presents, both challenges and opportunities. And this is one opportunity that we see in the state when it comes to the types of food that can be grown. So, one of the things that we are doing, we were planning on having a subsequent sale this year. I have directed my department to at least pause on that, because what we really like to do is take another strategic look at how we're going about doing these land sales, in particular, ensuring that the types of agricultural covenants and terms and conditions are such that enable the state to enforce and ensure that this land is going to be used for agricultural purposes. One issue, to Senator Bishop's earlier point, there is a lot of land out there that has been designated for agriculture that currently has agricultural covenants. The state has never, at least as far as I'm aware, ever really proactively taken steps to ensure that land is, if it's not being used for agricultural purposes, the state's never really taken steps to enforce those covenants. So the question to me is that before we want to release more agricultural land, I think we want to make sure that, again, we're doing this in a way to get the desired result. That is, make land available for farmers that are interested in increasing agriculture. And then, to me, that also has to be looked at in the context of Senator Bishop's earlier point, which is if we already have large amounts of land that are fallow, that aren't being currently farmed, it begs the question, is it really a supply of land issue, or are there other factors at play that are also important for us to look at and address? And I think it's a combination of both, because I think there is merit and value in having agricultural offerings in different parts of the state. Nenana is different climatologically than Delta. There's not as much wind there. There's different temperature and precipitation patterns. There's different topsoil. There may be differences in the water and minerals and so on and so forth, right? So that's not to say that we shouldn't be looking to develop new agricultural land, even though we have land that's fallow. But to me, it says there's a lot for us to look at, to analyze, to think through, and to be mindful of before we just go full bore into one endeavor after the other. So we want to make sure that we have success and actually see our desired result.
Senator Dunbar, question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be more a question for the DOT, actually, but perhaps you're able to answer it. So within the Nanatchaket project, I assume that the bridge and the road were probably built with a combination of state and federal dollars. How is maintenance paid for? So, we have a lower farm rate in the Natsu Borough, but presumably that covers at least some of the road maintenance and snow removal. Obviously, in Anchorage, we have limited road service areas. Does the state government collect any kind of property tax for maintenance on this road? Or is there a municipal government that does so? Or is it just purely, state dollars that keeps this? It sounds like a rather long access road into these acres clear.
Yeah, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, my understanding is this area is within the unorganized borough, so I do not believe that there is a local taxation authority that actually collects property taxes in the Nenana-Tchaket project area. I will happily defer over to Deputy Commissioner Goodrum that could probably provide more insight in terms of the maintenance agreements and obligations associated with the road and kind of the breakdown and split there between DNR and the Department of Transportation.
Deputy Commissioner, did you hear the question?
Yes, ma'am. For the record, Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, the road that moves out in this area, originally there used to be some exploration activity. I believe it was Otna that had drilled some exploration on an exploration pad out that way. And so the first 6 or 7 miles, which is road that is being improved by the Department of Transportation, is essentially that improvement of that road. And then they are working to create the initial access roads just into this first phase of the ag development, phase 1A. There isn't much more work right now that's gone beyond that, and it's, that work is still underway. To my knowledge, you know, there isn't snow removal or any of that that's ongoing during the winter. But I may have to get back to you further whether DOT has any other specific monies identified for maintenance on this new road that they're doing right now.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
No, that's interesting. Thank you, Director. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Before we go on, I just want to thank Senator Bjorkman for being here. Of course, we'll be hearing his bill in a moment, and I want to welcome Representative Himshute for joining us. She's been here for almost all of this meeting. So, Commissioner, you may proceed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just for the record, it's Doyon that had built the road, not Otton, just to clarify that. So on this next slide, we can see a number of the important grants that the Division of Agriculture is currently distributing. And these are very important. It's a very important function that our division fulfills. It's a significant part of the division's workload, and it's why it's very important that we have the proper amount of staffing and resourcing at the division so that we can manage these programs, because there, as you can imagine, there are a considerable amount of federal dollars available for agricultural purposes. I think our congressional delegation do a fairly good job trying to bring agricultural dollars to Alaska. I will say we probably we're a little more of the runt of the litter, I think, when it comes to the other states that end up getting agricultural dollars, but certainly there is a fair amount of USDA money that is available for farmers. And so, you know, some of these programs, like the Alaska Feed Grain Reserve Program, which I talked about earlier, which I think will be key to continue to foster and provide more opportunities for barley growers and grain growers in Alaska to be part of that, particularly our farmers out in Delta. And of course, a lot of these grants are ones that are directly geared to going straight to the farmers and the boots on the ground. So there's a direct correlation between the dollars coming into the state and diverting those dollars to the folks that actually need them. So, you know, one of the things you've probably heard about are the micro grants for food security. You know, that's a federal program that has been running for several years. Those are small grants. I think they generally top out at around $5,000 a person or $10,000 per organization for projects that help people be more food secure. So these are your kind of backyard farmers or your would-be small farmers that may not have a lot, but certainly play that role in helping to, whether it's raising eggs or producing honey or the other types of backyard farming that we see, those types of grants certainly help those types of folks, including with building things like greenhouses, small-scale herding, and livestock operations and subsistence, I should mention. So the division has roughly $2.2 million available to award this year. And this week, we actually launched our application period, which closes on March 15th. And it sounds like the floodgates have opened. We have dozens and dozens of applications that have already come in through the door. So Alaskans are certainly aware of these opportunities, and we're going to work very hard to ensure that we in turn get that money out the door and to those farmers that that have applied for this grant. To date, we've awarded grants to roughly 915 individuals, and you know, kind of based on the data that we've received from those applicants, that those 950 farmers have probably fed about 42,500 Alaskans. So we do get a little sense for where these dollars go and how these dollars actually translate to producing more food for Alaskans. And of course, the priority in these grant administered programs is really to look to Alaskans in rural areas that face significant levels of food insecurity. So that is a key element that that we look at. We're also very excited about the local food purchase program. You know, this is a program that has roughly $1.5 million in funding that the division has to distribute. It helps on both ends of the spectrum. That is, it's good for the producers to help create additional market, and it's also good for food pantries and clients and other recipients of the food that want to take advantage of the extra production that our producers are growing. And these funds can be for state and tribal governments to buy food locally to help support local or underserved producers. And this serves feeding programs like food banks that reach, you know, underserved communities. And we hope that the money will support the growth of food hubs, tribal farming, and kind of local farmers markets. And I think, as you know, a number of you have seen in Anchorage and a lot of our communities, we've seen a proliferation of farmers markets, which are a great forum to link up would-be buyers and sellers. And you know, in Anchorage alone, we have a number of farmers markets kind of spread throughout the municipality that, again, enables urban Alaskans to take advantage of produce being grown both, you know, locally within the municipality and from areas a little further distributed. And then lastly, on this, we have our plant material center and seed cleaning capacity. And really, this is a very, very important function that the Division of Agriculture fills. We're the only entity in the state that does seed cleaning to this effect. And so what is seed cleaning? Well, as farmers harvest crops, whether it's barley or other types of seeds, they want to retain a certain amount of those seeds to then be able to replant in a subsequent year. But as you can imagine, sometimes there are different non-desirable plants or weeds that can get mixed up in that. You know, the biblical analogy of the wheat and the tares, you know, that exists, that happens. And so we want to ensure that when farmers are planting new seeds, that they're able to, they're planting the seeds of the desirable crops, and that things that are weeds or that are invasives or other things like that are screened out. And so being able to clean seeds and process seeds for our local farmers is important. And it's actually also an incredibly important function when it comes to remediation and restoration work. So if you think of mining reclamation, you think of highway projects, you think of all the broadband infrastructure that we're looking to build out, pipeline rights of ways or just buried fiber optic line, as you disturb the land, it's important, of course, that we go back and we try to restore that to get natural vegetation to regrow. And so seed cleaning becomes very important in our ability to garner and gather local seeds of local grasses, things like fireweed, which, you know, by the way, like an ounce of fireweed is worth more than an ounce of cocaine in terms of price. Not that I, you know, price out cocaine regularly on the market, I guess I should add for the record. But the fact that it's incredibly expensive to try to gather fireweed seed, clean the spindly cotton material off that they produce to naturally distribute and winnow that down to a quantity that can be used then in a restoration project. And so this ability to be able to carry out that function is very important, and we see increasing opportunities for the state to provide that services to all the different operators needing to do this restoration work. So that is something that, we plan on working on and building out. And I guess I already talked to the slide without advancing it, so I'll skip one more here. So that brings us really to 2024, which, as I mentioned again, is really our year of strategic review. And really, this is, for me, an opportunity for us to assess the current status of agriculture in the state, and then really, again, think through what are the policies that we need to advance agriculture in the state. So I was privileged enough last year to be able to accompany Director Scoresby to a number of farming regions across the state to actually sit and meet with our local farmers. This included our lone dairy in the state, Alaska Range Dairy, which is in Delta Junction, which again produces the best milk that you can buy in Alaska. So if you want to visit any Walmart store across the state or Three Bears, you can buy Alaska Range Dairy. It's a non-homogenized milk, which means that the proteins within the milk haven't been altered through the homogenization process. And why is that important? Well, a lot of people that believe that they have sensitivity to milk or lactose intolerant can often find that by drinking non-homogenized milk, it works well with their systems. Because if you think about it, as we've evolved drinking milk, we drank milk that came straight from cows that didn't undergo these homogenization processes. And so for a lot of people, their bodies can digest those proteins much more efficiently. So that's just another plug. Plus their chocolate milk tastes like a melted milkshake. So it's quite a treat, and I encourage you all to look at it. But understanding what our farmers need and what we've got going on was a key part in this last year, and I continue to make efforts this year to get out and meet our farmers, understand kind of what they've got going on. But one of the things that has been very important to me, that again, to my knowledge, has never been done before, even though it seems like a relatively logical step, which is policymakers and directors of budgets that relate to agriculture, we didn't have, there's really no structure that's ever really brought us together. So that is, you know, in the state, you have the DNR Division of Agriculture, you've got the Farm Bureau, you've got the University of Alaska system, you've got the USDA, you've got the local soil and water conservation districts, and other entities that are key to setting agricultural policy, that each fulfill a mission and a purpose that assists in the building up of the agricultural community in the state. And there's not a mechanism by which we can all just come and sit together and talk about, hey, you know, what are you guys doing? And because as we think about the amount of money that we have available for ag, it is relatively limited. So, you know, I keep kind of comparing it to fielding a baseball team. It doesn't behoove us to have three people on third base and two shortstops and a catcher to not have a pitcher or folks out in the outfield, right? So it's how can we work together as a group, understand the missions and functions of each of these organizations, and ensure that we work in concert with one another so that if, you know, certainly if the university is focused on the research and development part of things, the Division of Agriculture within DNR can be focused on other elements. And the same for the Farm Bureau. And then the USDA also can kind of help figure out what gaps there are to fill, and we can work with them on finding funding sources or encouraging them to help fill gaps that we have in the overall agricultural system. So we've kicked off some inaugural meetings. We now have a monthly cadence of meetings, which includes a lot of these folks, including President Pat Pitney at the University of Alaska. And you know, I'm very hopeful to just kind of having established this partnership, this collaboration, and hopefully getting this precedent set in place that all of us can really pull together when it comes to expanding and increasing agricultural opportunities here in the state.
Senator Dunbar, question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to, I know we've got two other things we need to get to on the agenda, so I don't want to prolong this, but there is a question. So, you know, we've heard from the food policy folks earlier in the week and the Farm Bureau and others, that, and it goes very much what you just said. So their top recommendation is to pull the Division of Agriculture out of DNR and create a Department of Agriculture. Does DNR support that?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. That is certainly an option that I know that the governor's office is currently looking at. I think, you know, as I've met with those groups, I've certainly heard their ask made as well. Generally, to me, there's sort of two parts to that, as I understand it. One, they believe that by creating a department that you will elevate the cause of agriculture to the governor's cabinet level, and that will bring more attention to agriculture here in the state. And then secondly, it seems like a lot of the desire to create a Department of Agriculture also centers around resourcing. That is, they want to see a department that is more fully staffed, has more functions that are concentrated within it. So just as a for instance, currently the state veterinarian is housed within DEC. And in a lot of other states with the Department of Agriculture, the state veterinarian may be part of the Department of Agriculture. And so I think there's interest from farmers to have maybe a veterinarian that is geared towards agriculture within a Department of Agriculture. I think when you talk about regulation of pesticides and other things like that, again, currently that falls within DEC. I think there's folks in the agricultural community that love to see that function more under the Department of Ag, which they feel like would provide a different management philosophy, I guess, of the folks administering those types of programs, maybe help make them more responsive to the needs of farmers. So as I understand the request, it tends to center around those two kind of desires, I guess, to see overall.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
So brief follow-up. So the position of DNR right now is you don't have a position, and you and the governor's office are looking at that proposal. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, it's fair to say that we're supportive of the idea, and we certainly want to, you know, think through all of the implications of what creating a Department of Agriculture would entail.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bishop.
A quick comment, Commissioner, along your lines in the I'll just say arguments that the farmers are using for wanting to stand up their own Department of Agriculture. I get it, having a one-stop shop for your business. You know, it's like time is money, and you know they feel comfortable with the Department of Ag, and not that they're trying to skirt around any other laws as it pertains to fertilizer, but they go in one place, right, and they can take care of their business from A to Z. So I would agree with what they're trying to do.
In addition to bringing agricultural policy leaders together, the other thing that I've really worked to initiate is to solicit sort of best-in-class expertise. So one, the University of Alaska system has a relationship with the University of North Dakota, which is very important. And we're continuing to look at opportunities to build on that. For instance, the governor and I had the opportunity to travel to Indiana this last year. We met with Purdue University, specifically with Bernard Engel, who's the Dean of Agriculture at Purdue. Purdue has helped advise governments all over the world, actually, on how they can build out agricultural systems. They assisted Colombia, for instance, to rebuild its agricultural sector after their devastating civil war back in the 80s. And Purdue is very interested, actually, in creating opportunities for its own researchers and its own agronomists to have opportunities to come to Alaska to understand northern agriculture and to understand, to do research here. And conversely, provide opportunities for Alaskan researchers through the University of Alaska system or otherwise to go to Purdue and also learn there. So we're looking to kind of foster those relationships and hopefully even bring on an element of strategic consulting from Purdue so that they can help us think through, you know, most other states, agriculture just evolved naturally over time, right? From very early in our country's history to where states are today. In Alaska, we have this unique opportunity where we're sort of building the industry from the ground up. So we, through our policies and how we're structuring things, we have the ability to shape the nature and characteristics of agriculture in the state. And so, I mean, I can sit around all day long and pencil interesting ideas, but I'm not an expert. So it would make sense for us to consult with people that really understand the world of agriculture to kind of help us think through what we may need to consider when it comes to our agricultural practices and systems. And then lastly, working on building collaborative relationships with other northern sovereigns. So the Governor Dunleavy and I and a number of commissioners had the opportunity to travel to the Yukon just this past week. I met my counterpart, who's the minister over energy and mines and other things, which includes agriculture. There's a lot of opportunities, actually, for Alaska and the Yukon to develop a relationship with ag, whether it's sharing seeds or livestock or other things, and also particularly with research. So there's going to be a ministerial meeting in Whitehorse this summer that I've been invited to. The ministers for Northwest Territories and Saskatchewan and British Columbia will also be involved to really talk about Northern Ag, how we expand opportunities for agriculture in the North, and can kind of leverage each other when it comes to the research and other sort of data gaps that exist that we all face. In the Yukon, like us, similar story, very small amount of the food that they consume there is produced locally, and they want to grow and foster opportunities either locally or regionally where there's more confidence in the supply chain. So I've already hit on most of these, and I'll try to get through because I want to be mindful of the time, particularly the senator that wants to talk about his bill. We're going to continue to go through the strategic review, again, really take a hard look at what we need and where we can put our resources to get the most bang for the buck. Because fundamentally, as we talked about the desire for the potentially for creating a department, it comes down to resources and really what is going to get more resources into the hands of Alaskan farmers. And that's really where we want to be smart and prudent. With the budget that we have, we want to ensure that we even, at least from a start, get our Division of Agriculture staffed and prepared to deliver the amount of services and to take advantage of the goals of the grants and other federal funding opportunities that exist to distribute out amongst the agricultural communities. And of course, continue to advance opportunities like a Farmer Support Services Program, ensuring that we have that extension outreach so that the work that is being done can be communicated to and disseminated out, of course, amongst the end users. So, of course, challenges. We have a number of things that make it a little tough to be a farmer in Alaska, in addition to just the climate. Of course, we have market access. We have high costs. We have infrastructure and labor shortages, and we have the next generation of Alaskan farmers that we need to recruit. A lot of our farmers have been farming in the state for decades, and we're getting to an area where a lot of our prominent farmers are nearing the end of their working days. And so how we can incentivize and encourage and create a structure that helps young Alaskans jump into the world of agriculture and help drive our state forward are things that we want to do. And so, as you're familiar, we've got the current Crop Act bill that's making its way through the legislature. Again, we're kind of looking at what are some of these tweaks that we can make to help incentivize farming to lower risks, whether that comes from crop insurance or other things. And we're also looking at, we have a lot of different types of agriculture in the state, as I mentioned, from the backyard farmers to the larger farmers. And in some ways, if you can help grow certain segments of the agricultural economy, that is, if you can, if you create a lot more opportunities, let's say, to expand commercial farming, that can actually help lower input costs for smaller farmers by making machinery or equipment less expensive, by making things like fencing less expensive, by having more seed supply or more fertilizer supply or other inputs at a less expensive rate that can then help the smaller folks have greater economic opportunities to expand agricultural opportunities. So, you know, we will continue to work across the spectrum with all of our agricultural partners here in the state to, you know, find those opportunities. And then lastly, I'll just put in a plug for research. That generally falls within the wheelhouse of the University of Alaska system. It really is one of the most critical needs that the state has, because we can't expect farmers to invest hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars and then kind of gamble on, well, hey, can I experiment with this type of crop or that type of crop? I mean, it really, a lot of that risk should be borne by our land-grant university or the state to help identify what types of crops or things can be developed. And just as an anecdote, I had an opportunity to see the University of Saskatchewan's experimental farm. And it's amazing what they're doing there. I mean, one, they devote a lot of resources to ag because ag is a multi-billion dollar industry in that province. But they have a full suite of geneticists that are working every day to develop new strains of wheat, new strains of canola, new strains of lentils, or whatever it may be that grow in Saskatchewan and that are adapted to growing in different regions or different climate zones or different soils, where Saskatchewan has a lot of radioactivity actually in some areas of the province. And they had their wheat was tending to pull that radioactivity and store it in the kernels, which is a problem. You don't want to concentrate radioactivity anywhere where humans are consuming it. And so their geneticists really worked hard to find the genes that they needed to alter to not encourage the wheat to pull up that radioactive material into the kernels, right? That's just a long-winded way of saying that's really important work. It pays a lot of dividends to the farmers, because once the university and the experimental farm kind of prove these concepts out, that gets disseminated to their farmers, and that helps grow the community. And so I mentioned camelina earlier. Our university, in conjunction with the University of North Dakota, has grown camelina. And thus far, camelina is growing better here in Alaska than it is in North Dakota. And camelina could be a phenomenal feedstock for biofuel and create a lot of opportunities for Alaska to actually grow and produce biofuels. And then, as I also mentioned, camelina can be used as a great feed additive to help you know, our cattle industry and things like that. So promoting that work, ensuring that the university has the resources that it needs to conduct that research, I think is very important. And then, of course, you know, the Division of Agriculture is going to be happy to help support them however we can. So anyways, with that, I apologize. I went on a lot, but I love ag and it's exciting for me. I love meeting our farmers. We just have some cool stuff going on. You got to go see Alaska Range Dairy. He's got Roomba robots that clean the manure. The cows walk into these automatic milking machines that, as they're milked by these robots, the milk is analyzed for all sorts of different things. So the machine can tell if the cow's nutrients are right. The machine can tell if something's off and that the milk isn't good, and it can then make sure that milk doesn't get mixed in with the rest of the batch but is shunted to an area where it's under quarantine. And it's just amazing to see farmers utilizing the latest and greatest technologies here in the state to produce a great product. And so to me, it just reaffirms that we can do it here. We can produce our own milk. We can grow our own eggs. We can produce our own beef. And Alaska can become more food secure. So anyways, we're excited to continue that mission. And we appreciate this committee's and this body's support in our efforts to grow agriculture here in the state.
Commissioner, thank you. Agriculture is important, and that's why I always try to have this committee have at least a couple meetings on the subject. It is critical. And we've run out of time, but one of the things I wanted to talk about was marketing of it. It's great to hear Walmart is carrying the dairy products. Of course, Fred Meyer has the carrots, potatoes, and tomatoes. In the district that you and I share, we have a farmer. He employs H-2A visa employees. With the mandatory increase in wages, he didn't plant cucumbers last month because he knows he can't sell them. The cost will be too high with that increase in wage. So I brought this up to the governor. I brought it up to Senator Lisa Murkowski yesterday. I bring it up to you and Director Scoresby. I'm not sure what we can do about it, but it's a problem. At this time, we are ready to go to the next item, and I am going to turn the gavel over to my co-chair, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. All righty. I think we're ready. We've got about 25 minutes, and we've got a bill presentation and three invited testifiers. So, Senator Bjorkman, would you like to join us at the table with, are you soloing, sir?
Yes, sir.
I see your staff's listed, but I don't see any staff with you. So, all right. This is be the first hearing of SB 171, Residency Hunting, Trapping, and Fishing by Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much.
The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Senator Jesse Bjorkman. I hail from the banks of Cook Inlet, a little burg of Nikiski. Senate Bill 171, the goal is to ensure that only Alaskan residents enjoy the benefits of increased bag limits and additional harvest opportunities that regulations for residents provide. Alaska's residents are afforded additional opportunities to harvest Alaska's fish and game resources because we all live here, and many Alaskans rely on our fish and game stocks to feed ourselves and our families. Many of these additional harvest opportunities are found where we have personal use or rural subsistence opportunities. When people do not live permanently in Alaska, capitalize on fish and game laws meant for residents, they diminish harvest opportunities for year-round residents, now and in the future. We certainly respect Alaskans who choose to move away after many years in Alaska. However, what is happening more and more is that people who have established residency but now permanently live out of state are returning for only a few weeks or months, harvesting the bounty of our lands and waters and then exporting our resources for consumption out of state by non-Alaskans. This overharvest by people who are not present in Alaska for most of the year, who may meet our loose definitions of domicile but don't actually reside here, endangers our stocks of fish and populations of game. What Senate Bill 171 does is it matches the ongoing residency requirements for hunting, fishing, and trapping licenses with the residency requirements for the permanent fund dividend. The initial year-long waiting period for a resident license remains the same. However, maintaining residency means that someone meets the residency requirements for the dividend and is physically present in the state for most of the year, unless their absence is due to a reason that is allowed under the dividend's exceptions. Simply put, we believe that Alaska's fish and game resources that are harvested with resident licenses should be taken and utilized by year-round residents, not visitors who spend most of their time in other locales. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I will happily accept any questions that you might have, and I'm also prepared to go through a sectional of the bill.
Does anyone have any questions at this time? I think what I'm going to do is I think we've got a good overview there in light of where we're at for time. I want to go to our invited testifiers and to make sure we've got a distinguished list here, and I want to give them at least 3 minutes apiece to get through that, and then the next time we bring your bill up, you could go through your sectional then, sir.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to Mr. John Sturgeon first, President Alaska Chapter of the Safari Club International in Anchorage. Mr. Sturgeon, are you available, sir?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. If you're ready, I can go.
Yes, just put yourself on the record and who you are and represent in 3 minutes, please.
Okay, I'll be less than that. Good afternoon. co-chairs Gisel and Bishop and other committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. It's much appreciated. For the record, my name is John Sturgeon. I'm the current president of Safari Club of the Alaska chapter. We are the largest chapter in Safari Club with over 1,200 dues-paying members. In addition, we're the largest chapter they've ever had. And this last year, we won our fourth consecutive award for chapters, which is the Top Gun Award, as the fourth consecutive year. And obviously, we have a pretty super staff and board that does all this. We support Senate Bill 171, which is a change in the residency requirements for resident hunting and fishing licenses. Several reasons. One, using a PFD requirement as the same requirement that's for hunting and fishing licenses will assure only legitimate residents will get a resident hunting and fishing license, as Senator Borgman pointed out. And secondly, by doing this, we'll be increasing the number of non-resident hunting licenses, which will bring much more and much more needed revenue into the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, so that we can be assured that we can manage our fish and game the very best in any state. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have to say. I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right. Let me see if there's any questions from any of the committee members. I'm seeing none. And thank you for your testimony. I'd like to also recognize Representative Rebecca Hemshute in the room there from Sitka, and welcome to the committee. Sorry for not calling you out there a little sooner, but we're going to go to now to Mr. Ted Spraker, former chair of the Alaska Board of Game and Soldotna. Mr. Spraker, if you can hear us, put yourself on the record in 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Senator. It's good to talk with you again. For the record, my name is Ted Spraker. I live in Soldotna. And first, I'd like to thank the Senate Resources Committee for the opportunity today to testify on SB 171. This is something I feel personally that's long overdue. We need a process that we can check on residency and people that come up here to enjoy the benefits we have in Alaska. You know, before I get into this, I'd like to run down a little bit on my background. I worked as a wildlife biologist for the state fish and game for a little over 28 years. Soon after retirement, I was appointed to the Board of Game. I spent six terms, 18 more years on the Board of Game. And when I didn't put my name in for a seventh term and I stepped down from the board, I was elected as the president of the Keene chapter Safari Club International. So I've spent almost 50 years dealing with conservation and wildlife, but a lot of that dealing with the public and working with the public. And I wish I was coming to you today with some really hard, fast data and good numbers on what's going on. But, you know, this issue to me is kind of like speeding. We all know it happens, but very few people ever get caught. But one of the things that I've seen on the Kenai, I live close to the Kenai River, is that we're small towns, but we have at least six or eight of these large storage units, and they're full of boats and RVs and campers and so forth until about the middle of the summer, and then they're all gone. And then and later in summer, they're all back. So it just makes a person wonder, how many of these people are residents of Alaska, or do they just keep a boat up here? And I tried to do a little bit of research on this with Alaska Wildlife Troopers, but they said it's really hard to make a case when a person has a registered boat in Alaska, a registered vehicle in Alaska. You know, they know how to pronounce all the names correctly and so forth. So they really have a hard time making a case on this. But we certainly know what happens. So, Senator Bishop, with that, I'll close. But again, thank you very much. And I strongly support Senate Bill 171.
All right, Mr. Spraker, thank you for your testimony and thank you for your past service to Board of Game. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Mike Crawford, chair of the Kenai Soldotna Advisory Committee. Mr. Crawford, if you can hear us, would you please put yourself on the record in 3 minutes of testimony?
Yes, Senator. My name is Mike Crawford. I live just outside of Soldotna, Alaska. I have for over 20 years. I'm the current chairman of the Kenai Soldotna Fish and Game Advisory Committee, and have been for 15, 17 years. I've been on the committee for probably almost 20. I've been very active in the fish and game board process. I think I've talked to people over the last several weeks about this bill, and the only objections I've ever heard was, well, what if you don't get a PFD? And when it's explained to them that it doesn't require you to achieve a PFD, it just puts the same qualifications on it. I've got no negatives there. So it's a positive thing. It gives some teeth to some rules. As many people on this call and in the room there would understand that, when you get to a certain age, you get a lifetime hunting license, hunting, fishing, trapping license. And now if you move out of state, you still got that fantastic card that would allow you to not have to purchase licenses anymore. And I think there's some people that take advantage of that when they do move out of state. And I'll just refer to the two comments, the two different presenters prior to me with their comments. And it's a win-win for Alaskans to protect our resources for Alaska residents that should receive those benefits, and make sure that we've got some teeth behind those that want to take advantage of being a resident without being here all winter. So. With that, Senator, I'd be open to questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I do not see any questions, and thank you for calling in this afternoon. And with that, that is all of our invited testifiers. So I'm going to set this bill aside. Senator Dunbar.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Can we ask a question at this time, or do you want to wait till the next hearing?
You can. Just how long you want to stay. If you want to ask a question, you can.
I see the representative from Fish and Game here. I wonder if we could ask them.
We have the director of Wildlife Troopers online for questions, and there's Fish and Games in the room. You can bring them up and ask them a question.
I don't think this would be for – maybe I'll just try asking the sponsor of the bill first. So what the last testifier said was really interesting, if I might, Mr. Chair. So even though you are linking to the permanent fund dividends requirements, you're not saying you actually have to have a permanent fund dividend. But the permanent fund dedicates quite a bit of resources to sort of sussing out who can and cannot qualify for the permanent fund dividend for pretty obvious reasons. They have not a fraud unit exactly, I don't think, but they have people that do this work. And so I guess my question is, or perhaps for the head of the wildlife troopers, there's a zero fiscal note on here in terms of more enforcement costs. Is the thinking that a person who is accused of violating this provision could use the fact that they have a PFD as evidence that they have not violated? And then otherwise, how would the wildlife troopers or whomever go about determining that someone had been physically present in the state at all times? I know the PFD does things like asking for plane ticket stubs and that kind of thing. So I'm just curious about enforcement.
The answer to your question is yes, they could use evidence that they have received a PFD to show as proof that they met the residency standard of the dividend. Also, they could use all the same evidence that you would use to qualify for a dividend. Typically, when a person in the state shoots an animal like a brown bear, a mountain goat, or a sheep that requires a person to be a resident in order to hunt that animal without a guide, oftentimes the wildlife troopers will investigate those folks to make sure that they are indeed a resident. And one of the first things they will do is they will look at the dividend records to see if that person received a dividend. If they did not receive a dividend, they'll look deeper at those very things and start asking more questions. So a violation of the residency requirements for a resident license is often complaint driven. And then the troopers would dig deeper. This residency standard is much more easy to prove than the current domicile standard, which could be a post office box, a boat on a trailer, a raw piece of land, something to that effect. So this standard is much more easy to enforce.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Senator Klayman.
It's interesting because I have constituents who either because they snowbird and actually don't qualify for a dividend, or others that just choose not to apply for the dividend for whatever reason. This legislation, if passed, would not require one to get a dividend to get the resident hunting license. You would just be applying the same standards for both.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions from committee members today? Senator Bjorkman, thank you very much for the presentation. And we're going to set this bill aside. That'll conclude today's meeting, Monday, February 19th at 3:30 p.m. is our next meeting. And it's the first hearing of Senate Bill 220, RCA Regulate Natural Gas Storage, by Chair Senator Giesel. So, with that being said, we are adjourned at 4:50.